So I'd like to call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:03 p.m. on Thursday, February 2nd, 2023. And we're meeting today in Davis Room 106 of the Capitol Building. Please silence your cell phones out of courtesy to others. And with us today, we have Representative McCormick, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Sadler, Representative Sumner, Representative Fields, and Representative Mina. And myself, the chair, Representative Prox. And welcome back, everyone, to this meeting. And our committee aide today is Chadwick Vance, over to my right. And returning House Records Recorder, Lori Rowland, and Talia Ames, our teleconference moderator. And so this afternoon, we're going to hear an overview of the Department of Health. And here in the room to brief us, our Commissioner Designee Heidi Hedberg, Emily Rickey, Deputy Commissioner, Josie Stern, the Assistant Commissioner, Finance and Management Services, and much to our pleasant surprise, we have Dr. Zink with us. The Chief Medical Officer will be here in person instead of on teleconference. So, Commissioner Hedberg, if you would please come forward. Safety moment before you do that. Be mindful of the equipment down below the desk. We like to keep your kneecaps intact. So please put yourself on the record and begin the overview. And questions. Do you want to take questions as we go along, or do you want us to hold the questions till the end?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee, probably hold the questions till the end.
We
have 24 slides, and so I think we'll answer some of the questions towards the end.
And there will be a test, a multiple choice test, so have your questions prepared. All right, you're good. Please proceed.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And so today we wanted to provide a department overview and spend some time focusing and addressing the DPA, Division of Public Assistance, backlog. And so I'd like to, again, welcome my team. It's definitely a team effort. Health is very complex. So our Chief Medical Officer is Dr. Ann Zink. Deputy Commissioner is Emily Ritchie. We also have Josie Stern, who's our Assistant Commissioner, and Courtney Enright. She is our Legislative Liaison, and Heather Carpenter, our Health Policy Advisor. And so during this presentation, you'll actually hear from all of us. We all have different expertise that we're contributing to the collective knowledge on the department overview. So a little bit about me before we jump to the next slide. I have worked for the Department of Health, prior known as Department of Health and Social Services, for 13 years, all specifically within the Division of Public Health. The last 4 years I was the Director of Public Health. So I come from a prevention background. Prior to my state service, I worked 12 years in the nonprofit sector, and I graduated from Alaska Pacific University. So that's just a little bit about me. What I'd like to do is welcome up Dr. Ann Zink, and she's going to talk about the next three slides that really provides a framework on the health of the state.
Great. For the record, I'm Dr. Ann Zink. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the state of Alaska. It's wonderful to see many of you here again in person. I'm going to just provide a little bit of overview of kind of the state of Alaska's health to kind of ground us a little bit. A little bit about myself. I'm a practicing emergency medicine physician. Came up to Alaska initially in college, fell in love with the place and a person, and moved up here. Thought I'd be here for a few years after my residency, but the medicine, the people, the place were intoxicating, and I completely fell in love, and it's been an honor to serve here for the last 14 years. Last four of which have been in this role, 3.5, almost 4 years in this role as the Chief Medical Officer for the state of Alaska. But I quickly found that I was not able to care about my patients if I didn't care about the larger policies that affected them. Patients coming into the emergency department unable to or unwilling to get care for, say, their heart attack because they couldn't afford the cost of their care, didn't have a primary care to follow up. Those things kept me up at night and resulted in me starting to become more involved in policy and in this position. And one thing that very quickly became clear in my role as a practicing physician was just all the different pieces to a patient's health and how complex that can be. And I may see a bit of it. They may be showing up that day with chest pain. But behind that, maybe their access to care. Maybe they don't have a primary they can follow up with. Maybe they have recently lost their house, and that is impacting their ability to either get care, their sense of anxiety, their history, their adverse childhood experiences, their housing, their economic stability. We know that healthy people make up healthy economies, and we know that our health and well-being, 80% of our health is determined by things outside of the healthcare structure. And so when we think about what makes us healthy and well as individuals, we need to think not only about the healthcare delivery system, but the larger economies and the larger systems in which we all live and breathe and work to make sure that people are as healthy and well as possible to meet the mission of the Department of Health to promote and protect the health and well-being and self-sufficiency of every Alaskan in the state. There's a lot of different ways that you can measure this when you say, what does this make us healthy? How much are we spending on this? What are our goals? And I sometimes say that the goal that, you know, I have as a policy person may be somewhat different than I have as an individual and is somewhat different than I would have as a mother. The lenses in which we all look through healthcare can definitely vary. So there's a couple of national standards and ways that we oftentimes look through the lenses of healthcare to try to assess how are we doing and what does that look like. So I'm going to start off on the left-hand side, and this is leading causes of death in Alaska compared to the U.S. as a whole. Clearly, this changes over time. If you see life expectancy, we really saw prior to World War I and II a big increase in life expectancy as we had a good understanding of basic public health, things like clean water and sewer. World War I, World War II, the 1918 pandemic, you saw that dip. Diagnostic medicines really took off, and we saw a big increase in life expectancy after that. And unfortunately, even prior to the pandemic, particularly in the United States, we started to see a decrease in life expectancy. And that was thought a lot to do because of the systems in which care is delivered and what we call deaths of despair, suicide, homicide, alcoholism. And we see some of that reflected in Alaska statistics as well. So here you can see, looking at 2021 data, the leading causes of death in the U.S. as well as in Alaska were cancer, heart disease, and COVID. Clearly, 5 years ago, COVID wasn't on there, and hopefully moving forward, that one starts to kind of pull back off as a leading cause. And you can see that at different years and at different times, we've had different ratios compared to the U.S. as a whole. But I would highlight the three numbers in red there, that 12.6 for accidents, the 4.7 for suicides, and the 4.0 for liver disease. And those are the areas where we've had a statistically significant difference from the lower 48, where we've had more deaths per capita than what we see across the lower 48 for 5 years or greater. So you're seeing higher rates of accidents, suicides, as well as liver disease overall. And that can be from alcohol, could be from hepatitis, particularly hepatitis C, and that's kind of multifactorial. Another way that we can look at how well are we doing, what does this look like, is cost. And we know that cost is a big factor. Almost 20% of the national GDP is spent on healthcare, and this impacts every business, every economy, and it affects every person in one way or in another. So this is 2020 data, and this looks and compares life expectancy across states compared to how much we spend per capita. And so when we look at life expectancy, we're kind of right in the middle there. We're 29th in the country looking at life expectancy. Hawaii kind of standing up there as kind of the top end of life expectancy. Louisiana, Mississippi, West Virginia, kind of the bottom end for life expectancy overall. And Alaska's kind of right there in the middle for life expectancy. And when you look at cost per capita, you can see that we are the second most expensive cost per capita on this side there. And this has been true for some time. We've seen this vary over time, depending on the ways that structures of healthcare are set up, the way that healthcare is paid up. You tend to see very rural states in that region, but you've started to see, like, for example, New York more recently kind of come up to a more expensive state and currently is the most expensive state per capita. So you can see variation. And then places like Idaho, Utah are towards the end, kind of the cheapest cost per capita. So another way to measure health and just how much we're spending on it in comparison to life expectancy. So how do we move forward? What does this look like? And there's many great ideas and many ways that we move forward. And I would just like to point towards the committee, the Alaska State Health Improvement Plan. We call this Healthy Alaskans 2030. This has been a process that has been done with the state of Alaska in combination with the tribes for decades. And basically, we look at measurable things that we can all do something about that might improve our overall health and decrease costs. And we get together and we say, how can we make Alaska more healthy and more well, and what can we do about it? And there's different categories here. So healthy weight and nutrition, environmental health, healthcare access, alcohol, tobacco, substance misuse, mental health and suicide, injury and violence, infectious disease, cancer and chronic disease, social and preventative factors. We're currently working on our 2023 goals. I'm happy to provide the committee with details on what these goals are. We just released our 2020 two report cards. So how we did last year, and we released our 2020 10-year report cards. We did two at the same time. So looked at all of our data for 2010 through 2020 and what that report card looked like. And then we do yearly interim report cards as we go every year to say how we're doing. So we just released the total summary as well as the most recent years. Again, this is a partnership with our tribes. We have goals and metrics both for Alaska Native people as well as Alaska as a state. And it serves as a roadmap for stakeholders to work together. And I encourage every time I get an opportunity to share about how we can move forward this roadmap, because we need as much help as we can get to make difference on all of these measures to be able to move forward to become as healthy and well as possible. So with that, I'll hand it back over to Commissioner Designee Hedberg.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee. And on slide five, strong families are the foundation for a healthy society and vibrant economy. And the fundamental principle is the catalyst for the governor's initiative on healthy families. And there's three pillars that really create this initiative. It's healthy beginnings, improving access to health care that includes behavioral health, and the third is healthy communities. So each of these pillars encompasses multiple strategies and tactics, including administrative actions, statutory changes, staffing and budget adjustments, and cross-agency collaboration. And the first pillar, Healthy Beginnings, is the cornerstone of healthy families. This pillar prioritizes maternal and child health. It emphasizes prevention measures for youth, like healthy diets and physical activity, and works towards expanding and improving child care and after-school programs. The second pillar is improving access to health care, and again, it addresses both mental and physical health care, which is fundamental to healthy families. This pillar focuses on working with partners to create a robust and resilient healthcare workforce, and it supports aging in place and aligns how we pay for healthcare to reflect better health outcomes and higher value for the whole person care. And the third pillar, healthy communities, builds on existing efforts to create healthy workplaces and work with partners to increase safe and affordable housing. It will reduce the burden of infectious diseases such as tuberculosis and address chronic diseases by launching the Fresh Start campaign to connect Alaskans to prevention programs. This initiative is supported by ongoing federal funds and current general funds. But it's also elevating these programs and expanding these programs. And the goal is over the next 4 years that together we would have a collective impact that would really impact the next 50 years. So for the next slide, I'd like to introduce Dr. Ann Zink.
And for the record, I'm Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer for the state. So to build a little bit on what Commissioner Designee Hedberg just talked about, you know, healthy people are cheaper people to care for within the system. And so when we want to think about healthcare costs, a good way to do that is to think about how we can move people towards a healthier state. And that's much cheaper usually done from prevention. And unfortunately, our system is really not set up for prevention. And that is a lot of our goal with thinking about healthy beginnings, healthy families, healthy communities. How can we transition the really limited and wise dollars that we have to move towards prevention to have healthcare savings across the board as much ways as possible? So reducing healthcare costs while improving the health outcomes of Alaskans. So we have a couple things that we're really thinking about. And here, looking on the right-hand side, you can see that we have some challenges in the state. You can look at healthcare expenditure per capita in Alaska compared to the U.S. as a whole. In about 2000, you started to see really a divergence between how much we were spending per capita as well as the lower 48. We had a lot of increased services up here that we weren't able to provide in other ways, but that has come at a cost, and we continue to try to reflect on and do things that we can to try to help to keep down costs and keep people as healthy and well as possible. So some things that we're looking at is a position specifically within the Department of Health Commissioner's Office, and it's the Office of Health Savings. We purposely titled it the Office of Health Savings to be both health care savings, so care savings people's health, as well as cost savings. So it's both of those things. So it's not one or the other. The initial focus will be focusing on the Medicaid program, and so what way that they can be the payer of last resort, making sure that other payers are paying in Medicaid that last as they're supposed to be. Innovative payment models, particularly for pharmacy, and if you really look across the country, pharmacy costs continue to be a rising cost of any health plan, and so what can we do, not only within the Medicaid, but working with the Department of Division of Insurance and others to look at access to pharmacy and pharmacy costs overall. And then also exploring innovative payment models to, again, move towards this idea of paying for prevention and moving upstream to really use each dollar as wisely as possible.
Great. So the next slide, I just want to reflect that on July 1st, the Department of Health and Social Services split into two, and that was the executive order of 121. And so we are presenting on the Department of Health. On Tuesday, there was a presentation by the Department of Family and Community Services. And so this slide is really a reminder on where the divisions went with each of the departments. And so as a reminder, the Department of Health has the division of public health, behavioral health, seniors and disabilities, healthcare services, and public assistance. And so we look at the prevention, we look at the cost and the payment, and we pay for a lot of the services that are provided by Department of Family and Community Services. So we will always be interlinked. We are both departments are HIPAA compliant, and so we work very, very closely together, but they're distinctly different. So in addition to the update on the department split, I just wanted to kind of reflect that while the department split on July 1st, there are still some areas that we continue to work and address. Part of that is our IT, information technology, IT resources. And while the positions split and a lot of the data systems went with their respective programs, the back structure are still very much interlinked. And so this year, as the focus is creating a roadmap, it's really identifying what are the resources necessary for the Department of Health, what are the IT resources necessary for the Department of Family and Community Services. And so together, we're working with our IT staff to develop that roadmap so that we can appropriately separate our IT infrastructure. We recognize from that May 2021 attack, cyber attack, that really we're in a technology debt and it's impacting our systems across both departments. In addition, really we look at that continuum of care and we look at the individual. While the Department of Family and Community Services provides a lot of direct services, Department of Health is focusing on the population, the health of the population, and they're very much interlinked, and that's that continuum. So we want to make sure that every Alaskan is not lost in the bureaucracy of these programs, but they're receiving the right care at the right time, and the systems are supporting Alaskans. And that includes complex care. And how do we manage these and support these Alaskans? They're very complex. They're utilizing multiple programs within both departments. So on slide 9, I want to talk about financial management services. And this division is really the backbone. It's the spine behind the Department of Health. This division has budget, revenue and finance, information technologies, human resources, grants and contracts, program integrity, and Medicaid allocation audit services. And one of the two key areas that I just wanted to highlight with FMS, as it is fondly known, is grants and contracts. They coordinate over $173 million in FY22 to over 500 grantees. That includes nonprofits and government agencies, or municipal governments, I'm sorry. And the second is that the Medicaid Integrity Program, they recovered or avoided costs from fraud, waste, and abuse investigations for $7.8 million in FY22. And with that, I'd like to invite up Deputy Commissioner Emily Ritchie. She oversees the divisions of Seniors and Disabilities, Behavioral Health, and Healthcare Services, and she'll provide an overview of those three divisions.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Emily Ricci. I'm the Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Health. I started at the department in November. It's about 10 days before Commissioner Designee Hedberg, and I've spent over 10 years working for the state of Alaska in various positions, most recently running the state's employee and retiree health insurance plans. So the next few slides are a very brief overview of the key divisions that combined make up Alaska's Medicaid program. And the first division I'm going to speak to today is the Division of Senior and Disability Services. This division is focused on serving Alaskans with disabilities and those who are elderly or vulnerable. The division has approximately 170 staff that provide a wide range of services. Some of the more well-known programs are listed on the slide, but I would note that these are just a snapshot of the programs that the division oversees. It's not exhaustive. One of the most important things this division does is to administer the home and community-based waivers. Alaska has taken a long-standing position of working to assist individuals in remaining independent and in their homes and communities for as long as possible. These programs allow for Medicaid to cover home and community-based services for individuals who would otherwise be served in institutions or nursing homes. There are five different waivers that the division manages, focusing on different categories of needs and care services. In FY22, approximately 5,500 Alaskans were served by these waivers, covering nearly $281 million in total services, combined state and federal funds. Other programs managed by the division include Adult Protective Services, the Infant Learning Program, and the General Relief Program. The team in the division works very hard to ensure the programs they offer are robust. One of their accomplishments was a 10% Medicaid rate increase for home and community-based providers, which was included in the FY23 operating budget. The new rates took effect July 1st, and we appreciate the legislature's support in making that happen.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. Are we doing questions at the end or in process?
We're going to hold them to the end.
The division also leveraged $8 million in federal funds for two projects. The first focused on providing short-term relief to providers to cover recruitment and retention costs, and the second to establish a training and certification program for direct support professionals through the University of Alaska Anchorage. Around 225 providers benefited from the short-term relief, and 115 direct service professionals are enrolled in the UAA certificate program. The division also took lessons learned from the pandemic and adopted some regulatory changes focused on promoting safe and flexible options using technology. These included things like allowing first aid training for providers to be completed online and expanding the use of video conferences for services like care coordination. Okay, thank you. So moving to slide 11, we're going to talk about the Division of Healthcare Services. I really think of this division as the heartbeat of the Medicaid program. Staffed with around 180 positions, this division is responsible for the claims processing and the payment system for almost all Medicaid services. This means they are managing weekly check writes of between 45 and 50 million while processing 6.3 million claims alone in FY22. In addition, the division manages several different units with functions that impact healthcare services and providers around the state. This includes a background check unit, the residential licensing and facilities licensing unit, the pharmacy program, transportation needs, and tribal reclaiming. One of the largest challenges for healthcare services this year was staffing, and this was felt most acutely in the background check unit, where they experienced high absences and staff vacancies. And I know this is a story that is familiar to many aspects of state government, as well as anyone trying to provide services in the public or private sector. This was combined with a manual process and cleanup project from the cyber attack and the additional behavioral health provider types, which increased applications. This is good news that there were additional behavioral health provider types that were essentially applying to complete the background process, but it did add additional volume to the system at a time of thin staffing. So these factors ultimately resulted in longer than standard turnaround times and delays this fall. Since December, the unit is back at full capacity and processing times have dropped to 4 business days following receipt of a complete application. And so we know this is an area that's been difficult for providers. We hear about it frequently. But we are committed to maintaining those low turnaround times and finding ways to improve the system. Healthcare services has also had some substantial successes that I know are really important and of interest to the committee. An important item was the procurement and award of the fiscal agent contract. So fiscal agent services are a core component of how the division processes claims, and rebidding those systems is very complex and challenging. Some of you may remember the conduit transition in 2013, fiscal agent services are part of the same services that are necessary to process claims. The division completed the procurement for fiscal agent services, and the contract was awarded this fall to a company called HMS. This means that a portion of the work that is currently being performed by conduit will transition to HMS on April 1st. We know this is a high priority, and it's important to be to get it right. And I can tell you the division is fully focused on this. But April 1st is a big date for this division as that fiscal agent transition occurs. Other successes focused on meaningful savings. Some highlights include over $155 million in claims recovery, where another payer or insurer was in the primary position. This relates to that concept of Medicaid being the payer of last resort that Commissioner Designee spoke about earlier in the slides. And $45 million in savings from leveraging pharmacy discounts and efficient management. In addition, the division has been able to save over $74 million through tribal reclaiming, and these are preliminary savings. We anticipate they will grow. Okay. So moving on to slide 12, we're going to talk about the Division of Behavioral Health. This division is responsible for the publicly funded behavioral health continuum of care. It has 123 positions and an annual budget of around $96 million. The division has five operational sections managing several programs. Some of these include the Tobacco Enforcement Program, the Alcohol Safety Program, Treatment and Recovery Coordination and Support, and the Suicide Prevention Program. The division also manages a robust collection of treatment and recovery grants to community providers. The treatment and recovery team within the division managed roughly 180 grant awards in FY22. The division provides a continuum of statewide behavioral health services, so mental health and substance use services, ranging from prevention and screening to brief intervention and acute psychiatric care. One of the most important initiatives managed by the division is the expansion of covered behavioral health services through the implementation of a Medicaid Section 115 waiver. You'll hear references to the 1115 waiver very frequently, I think, in committee presentations to come. This is an innovative Medicaid demonstration project that allows the state to bill Medicaid for services that would not otherwise be covered, but are really essential to building out and maintaining that behavioral health continuum of care. In FY22, nearly 190 million waiver claims were paid and processed. The waiver was fully implemented in 2020 and is currently in the process of renewal. Additionally, the division has proposed a 4.5% rate increase to behavioral health care providers offering services through the 1115 waiver. That rate increase is in the regulatory process, and public comment on that just closed. The Division of Behavioral Health, in collaboration with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, continues to work with community providers to support the development and implementation of the Crisis Now model. And that is a systemic approach to building a robust behavioral health continuum of care. It's a model that's become quite popular in other states and has tremendous promise. Over the next 2 years, the Division of Behavioral Health will be organizing and implementing technical assistance for organizations around the state who have expressed interest in providing 23-hour crisis observation and stabilization services or crisis residential and stabilization services. So a lot of work happening in this division.
Great. Thank you so much. On slide 13, I'd like to invite up Dr. Ann Zink. She oversees the Division of Public Health.
Great. Thanks. For the record, I'm Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer for the State of Alaska, and I oversee the Division of Public Health. The Division of Public Health is a large division. We have almost 500 employees. It's very important to notice that what happens in the state of Alaska is quite different than other states for public health. Most other states, their public health is very county-based, and they have kind of county tax base that forms that. We really have tried to consolidate what we have in the state, yet trying to reach every aspect in every region of the state so that we can take advantage of skills and expertise such as epidemiologists, our medical examiners, and others to be able to reach out and be able to support the state broadly. We have eight different programs that do a wide range of services. So we have our chronic disease prevention and health promotion section. They have recently launched the Fresh Start campaign. This is a campaign to link any Alaskan who would like access to free services to help manage chronic conditions with existing free services. So diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, weight loss. This kicked off the end of last year. We have a website and campaign along those lines. They also work with primary care providers across the state to really address chronic disease and promotion and work upstream, again, on the lines of trying to help keep healthcare costs down and people as healthy as possible. We have our section of epidemiology, which became more well-known over the past few years than previously known. They do everything from disease investigation and outbreaks, such as new viruses like COVID, and we saw them in the past year, But during COVID, identified a new type of orthopox called Alaska pox to identifying foodborne outbreaks that exist. They are the ones who are helping to identify a recent outbreak of HIV cases that we're having and trying to make sure that we're getting information and promotion and getting people connected to services. They have our entire STI committee, so looking at sexually transmitted diseases. Unfortunately, we really are seeing a resurgence of many, including syphilis, and why you see part of that in the governor's budget. And then big part of their work is on tuberculosis. We have about three times the rate of tuberculosis in the state than the nation as a whole. And unfortunately, we have really started to see an increase in tuberculosis cases, as it takes a lot of work and time to really identify cases early, and for prevention efforts and treatment takes many months of treatment, making sure people are taking their treatment regularly. And with COVID and all of the challenges we've had over the past few years, there has not been able to be as much time and effort put in that space, because people have been more close together in their homes and others, as we've seen a lot of TB cases recently. So there's a lot of work happening on that front. Our health analytics and vital records, this is who does our birth certificates, our death certificates. They were very impacted by the cyber attack. They are up and running. There is a very large death report that they do every year. This helps to drive a lot of our data and information to understand what's causing people to die in the state. What do we know about this? How can we make sure that we can understand the information? There are a lot of our data analysts as well. They did a lot of work during the COVID pandemic to help setting up dashboards, and a lot of our data scientists, and also getting that information out to the Alaskans. Our state public health laboratories, I recently heard described public health laboratories as kind of the very point of the arrow for being able to respond to anything and any sort of disease. They have been crucial to us for the past few years. They provide a critical role to many of the hospitals, providing services that the hospital may not have the capacity to or the resources to look for some rare diseases, so they oftentimes receive in additional samples that they can, that only that they can do. During the COVID-19 pandemic, they were the only place to do COVID testing for multiple months, while most other states had commercial laboratories who were able to stand into this space. And so their ability to stand in and work as that gap filler until the commercial market was able to stand in was critical for us, particularly for those few, first few months. They still do a lot of our genetic sequencing and are a critical key to the entire state's laboratory system. Our public health nursing section is kind of that hands into communities. So we have public health nurses stations across the state. One thing to note, a real highlight for us in the past year, is we were able to eliminate the age restrictions for services at public health centers. This has been a desire of ours for years, to make sure that if the services we offer Alaskans need, we're able to provide services regardless of age. That's been a big, exciting success, and have been working hard on recruiting some unfilled positions in that space. Our rural and community health systems, which is where Commissioner Designee Hedberg had come from before she was the director, oversees our EMS, our trauma, our hospital response system. Currently, they're doing daily hospital calls with our hospitals that continue to be quite overwhelmed, to look at back transfers, trying to help to maximize the services that we have in the state, to keep people in state, and to make sure that Alaskans are able to provide the services and care that they need whenever the hospital system is quite strained. And looking at, again, how can we work with EMS, upstream prevention, and what happens in rural community systems of care. Our state medical examiners, they do not do medical examination of everyone who passes away, but high-risk people where additional information can be very useful, such as an overdose or a sudden unexplained death in a child, and they are based here in Anchorage. And then our women and children's and families health, they do everything from the women and children's nurse outreach program. They work with pediatricians who have been, I know, around the Capitol here today, and they are helping us with the postpartum Medicaid, extending that coverage. A couple things I also wanted to highlight. This is the section that does the Healthy Alaskans 2030, working with our community partners. I mentioned the age restrictions and expanding work to address the opioid epidemic. So our OSMAP office sits within chronic disease prevention. So everything from distributing naloxone kits to working with communities to understand the impact, as well as to help mitigate the significant impact of the opioid epidemic in communities, all lies within this region. Challenges that we've had over the past couple years, clearly COVID has resulted in a lot of additional and different work, but there's also been new and different expectations on this section that they're continuing to find ways to pivot. And much of our federal grant funding is coming to kind of a fiscal cliff ending in FY24 and some in FY25, as a lot of those federal dollars are really shifting and drying up. So how do we meet the expectations and needs of our community with really rapidly changing federal landscape dollars? I'll hand it back over. Thank you.
Great, thank you. For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee, and I oversee the whole department, but directly oversee the Division of Public Assistance. And so what I want to do, you'll see various slides on public assistance. I want to talk about the work that they do to talk about the SNAP backlog, what caused it, what are the solutions, and the work that we're doing with our partners and the suggestions that they have provided and the department's response to those suggestions. So on slide 14, the Division of Public Assistance promotes self-sufficiency and provides basic living expenses to Alaskans in need. And the division oversees 18 programs and provides public assistance to 1 out of 3 Alaskans. And so what I want to do is go over those 18 public assistance programs and those categories, just so you can have a snapshot of what that looks like. So in food and nutrition assistance, there's 8 different public assistance programs. The most what Alaskans are aware of is a Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. That is the largest food and nutrition assistance program, also known as SNAP. The next is a Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Education Program, SNAP-ED. There's Women, Infant, and Children, also known as WIC. And then the others are not as common, but still very important. It's Breastfeeding Peer Counseling Program, Commodity Supplemental Food Program, the WIC Farmer Market Nutrition Program, Senior Farmer Markets Nutrition Program, and the Pandemic EBT, also known as the Electronic Benefit Transfer. This, during the pandemic, when kids missed school because of school closures due to the pandemic, kids that were eligible for free lunches received funding directly on an EBT card so that they could go out and purchase food. That was a manual process, and that was a partnership with the Department of Education that shared with us who was eligible for these benefits, and then the Division of Public Assistance manually calculated that and then pushed those funds out to the EBT card. The next group is medical assistance. So there's 2 medical assistance programs, Medicaid, which resides within healthcare services, and then chronic and acute medical assistance, also known as CAMI. The next group is assistance to seniors and disabilities, which has the adult public assistance and senior benefits program. The next group is heating and water assistance. So there's 3 programs, heating assistance, water assistance, and a third called Alaska Affordable Health Program. The next group is assistance for families with dependent children, so the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program, also known as ATAP, and the Child Care Assistance Program. And then finally, the third is sort of the other category, and it's called the General Relief Funds, or General Relief Assistance. And the General Relief Assistance provides for emergent basic needs for shelter, utilities, food, clothing, or burial, and the division most commonly sees requests for burial assistance. So that's a snapshot of the 18 different public assistance programs that the Division of Public Assistance manages. So now I'd like to, on slide 15, I want to talk about what caused the SNAP backlog. I started my position November 16th, 2022, and have spent the last almost 3 months now focusing on DPA and understanding the programs, workflows, delays, and identifying solutions to address the immediate and long-term needs of the division. And in my role, I have outreached and listened to clients impacted by the backlog. I have called clients and listened to their stories. I have met with service providers and advocacy groups who are hearing and seeing the direct impacts from the delayed assistance. And I have called and talked with the Governor's Office on Constituent Relations and the Ombudsman's Office, whose staff are receiving calls from very frustrated callers. I've also listened to the ASEA Union share their concerns for the field staff at the DPA offices. And I visited 2 DPA offices and talked with staff and heard their frustrations, concerns, and solutions. I've also attended, they have a daily field services huddle meeting, and when I can, I attend and I hear them triaging the staff and providing updates on workflow efficiencies. And I share all of this to demonstrate that I recognize the impacts these delays are having on Alaskans and that we're doing everything in our power to focus on the solutions so that we can address the immediate crisis and mitigate future disruptions. In my short 3 months, there's sort of 3 high-level causes of the backlog, and that's due to the legacy IT systems, a cyber attack that delayed the planned improvements to the IT systems, and the burden of the pandemic that required additional manual processing of benefits to eligible Alaskans. So slide 16 has a picture, and it's some of you are familiar with this picture. Some of you may have used a computer system. This is a COBOL screen, and this is one. This is a picture of what one of the systems looks like, and it's the eligibility information system. And so in December, I visited the Anchorage DPA office because I wanted to first personally go and thank two of our eligibility technicians who had just a couple of weeks prior had performed CPR on a client that had collapsed in the hallway. And that is an experience that not many people go through. And so I really wanted to go there, visit with them, hear their story, and thank them for their service and the work that they did. And they performed CPR until the ambulance showed up and they took the client to the hospital. But I also, walked around, I talked with the eligibility technicians, and I wanted to spend time with one of them to really understand why you couldn't simply click a button to issue benefits. What caused the backlog? What were the system issues? I'm a visual person. I'm a hands-on person. I really needed to just be in the environment to really understand what was going on. And so if you can imagine, and I'll share with you, when I went into the eligibility technician's office, it's a beautiful office. She had she called herself a COVID baby because she was hired during the pandemic to help with the manual processing. She was very proud of that. And she had four computer screens in front of her. She had a computer, and then she had a separate keyboard over there, and she had a blank sheet of paper with a pen. And I said, I'm here to learn. I want to see what you do. And so I did not interrupt her. I did ask a couple of questions just to understand the process. But what she did was she went to the virtual call center where the information is collected, and then it's transferred into the workflow management system. She's collecting the name of the client, their number, and she's writing this down, and she's using her mouse to copy and paste, and then she's manually typing it in to this DOS system known as EIS, or Eligibility Information System, going through that process. She then spends the next 40 minutes taking that client through eight other systems to go and verify the information or to make sure that the right buttons are clicked in order to issue those benefits to that individual. She didn't complete the task. And again, it wasn't because I was asking questions. It's because our IT systems are not integrated and they're not talking with each other. And so we have a very manual process that our eligibility technicians are going through. So slide 17, I wanted to kind of understand more what those systems were. It was very enlightening for me, so I can share that story and really work on the resources to address these system issues. As I mentioned, there's nine different systems, and so on the slide, it lists what those nine different systems are. We have one programmer that knows how to write the mainframe language to update the EIS system. And we have two contractors that are supporting that one person. And in the next slide, I'll provide another update. But that was the current situation several weeks ago. So this is one of our limiting factors. And I want to invite Emily Ritchie up. She's going to talk about the SNAP and Medicaid backlog on slide 18.
Before we do that, I need to note that Representative Snap joined us at 3:34. Thank you. Please proceed.
For the record, Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health. So looking at slide 18, in November, a group of technicians was specifically assigned to be working through the older SNAP recertifications and applications. Currently, all September recertification benefits have been issued, and the team is working through October recertifications. But that being said, we are in the beginning of February, and the division is still working through October, which we understand is not acceptable for those Alaskans who need and are entitled to these benefits. We understand that, and as will be very clear from Commissioner Designee's future slides, we are totally focused on addressing this. And I know in a few slides, we're going to talk about some of the efforts that are underway to do this. And while the focus is on the SNAP program, the backlog has also had an impact on certain Medicaid applications and renewals. The same team that is focusing on processing the outstanding SNAP applications would also be processing Medicaid applications. So their shift in focus combined with the overall backlog of applications means that some Medicaid applications are delayed. These include new Medicaid applications that are submitted without a SNAP application, as well as those stored in the legacy eligibility system, that EIS system that Commissioner Desimy showed on the last slide, and which may be coded as requiring recertification. A compounding factor is the influx of new applications from the annual enrollment period from the federally facilitated marketplace, also known as the federal exchange. And that closed in January. There's typically an open enrollment period from around October through December or January, and individuals who apply for the exchange and are not determined to be eligible because their income level is lower than what the exchange is designed for are transferred to Medicaid program and to the Division of Public Assistance for processing. So at the same time, we've seen an influx of applications from that annual process. It's very difficult to estimate how many applications are delayed because the system is unable to determine duplicate applications, those which have been processed but are still being maintained in the system due to coding errors, or those which may have been submitted in error. Generally, Medicaid enrollment can be retroactive 90 days past the date an eligible application was received. So this means that if an individual submitted their Medicaid application in January but incurred healthcare services that December in the month before, and then the application ends up being processed towards the end of February, that all of their eligible healthcare claims back to December could be covered retroactively by Medicaid. So you do have that 90-day retrospective review.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee. So slide 19, the next two slides is on the virtual call center. And on slide 19, I want to talk about the intent of the virtual call center. And slide 20, I'll talk about the challenges. So one in three Alaskans rely on public assistance. And since the inception of the Division of Public Assistance, we have struggled to serve all Alaskans equitably because there's only 11 DPA offices across the state. So the solution was to create a virtual call center to ensure equitable access to all Alaskans and address the overcrowded offices that are at times has been an unsafe situation for the clients and employees. The goal of the virtual call center that went live April 2021 was to allow a client to call and talk with an eligibility technician and have their application processed during the call. During April 2021 to September 2022, when a client called and talked with an eligibility technician, their application was processed, interviews were scheduled, and there was a positive contact with that client. That all changed in October of 2023 when the DPA virtual call center was overwhelmed with callers. So slide 20, in October when the call volume peaked at 2,000 calls a day, the change was made to place our newer eligibility technicians with support with seasoned staff on the virtual call center to collect basic information and with our seasoned eligibility technicians on processing applications. This allowed clients to talk with an eligibility technician and answer basic questions. DPA was able to answer more calls with this change. On Wednesdays, additional staff are reassigned from the virtual call center to processing applications to try and get ahead. And I understand that there's a lot of frustrations with the virtual call center. When any of us are on call for more than 5 minutes, I think that we get frustrated. And we understand that there are clients that are on call for multiple hours. And so part of that recognition and acknowledgement, again, is where bringing on additional staff to, again, take the basic information, answer the basic questions, and then processing applications and sort of dividing that is currently what we're doing right now. So the question is, what are we doing? What are the immediate efforts the Department of Health is taking to address the backlog? And there are five different focuses of efforts, and we have updates, which we're very excited to share with you today. So these conversations, again, started back in mid-November when I started and we started to recognize that there was a problem. And so these ideas came November, December, and January. So the first, as I previously mentioned, we're working with the Office of Information Technology, also known as OIT, and the Department of Health IT to secure additional contractors that know how to program the eligibility information system that is on the mainframe. It's old and antiquated IT languages, and it's really hard to find those staff because it's an ancient IT language. So we are working on that. In addition, we have two vacant positions. We had a successful recruitment, I think probably because of all of this media attention. And we have candidates that actually have experience programming the mainframe. And so right now we're working through those two vacant positions, the interviews, the hiring. And so we will have three instead of one programmers that can reprogram our EIS system. So that is good news. In addition, we have a contractor that we've been working with and we've asked them to increase their hours. So we changed the contract so they can provide more support to the reprogramming of the eligibility information system. And the long-term goal, the short-term goal is the reprogramming of the EIS system and to put that EIS system into a position where it can then we can take the two programs, SNAP and Medicaid, off of EIS and migrate it over to ARIES. ARIES is the newer system, and get off of the mainframe. That will allow for more efficiencies with our eligibility technicians. So instead of 9 systems, there's 8 systems. So these are some of the initial steps that we are taking. In addition, we are one of the suggestions from our eligibility technicians and the leadership was that to have additional staffing support for the virtual call center. So we're doing two things. One, we've secured a temporary time-limited staffing contract. It's just 18 months. If we don't need it for 18 months, we'll shorten it. But we have a contract with one of the existing vendors to staff the virtual call center. So right now there's on average around 30 employees that are on the virtual call center. The staffing contract will have 75 individuals. So it will help answer those phone calls. It will also help us position us in it better. So when we do the Medicaid redetermination that starts April 1st, that we will have more staff to answer the phone and collect the basic information. Federal rules require that the state make the determination. So this very time-limited short contract is just to answer the calls, collect the basic information, and to share that information with our eligibility technicians who are trained and understand all of the rules and requirements for each of these programs. In addition, I want to acknowledge that we continue to recruit and onboard our permanent eligibility technicians and our long-term non-perm eligibility technicians. So we have 45 long-term non-perm positions that are there to support this arc of effort. And what we have seen is that we had 4 recruitments for these positions. We're receiving a lot of applications. They're not all qualified for the positions. We're, for a variety of reasons, you know, we need to make sure you know how to operate a computer, that you can learn the IT systems, and sometimes it's not the right fit for that applicant. So good news, we're seeing a lot of applications. The better news is that we are filling those positions, and there's cohorts of 14 that are working through the onboarding and going through the training process. The training team has modified their training to 8 weeks just specifically for SNAP. So the staff are doing a great job in really that onboarding and recruitment for these positions. But it's going to take additional resources to get through this hump and to prepare us for the Medicaid redetermination process. The third effort is crisis communication. We did secure a small contract with a communication company to help us message out to Alaskans and be proactive in what caused the SNAP backlog, what is the work that we are doing, really acknowledging the frustration and really being proactive in our communication and answering questions. We, in our public information team, we had three of our public information officers were vacant. So we were in a bit of a crisis with communication. I'm very thankful to announce that on Monday, one of those positions was filled. And so we have staff, we are filling those positions. Again, it's going to take the collective positions and contracts to get through this hump. The fourth area of focus is security. It's really unfortunate that we've had some threats within our offices, and we take them very seriously. And so we need to make sure that our staff feel safe coming to work. So we're doing two things. One, we have security guards that will be at our four main offices in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Matsu, and Juneau. And two, just we need an evaluation of the 11 offices and how we can make sure that they are safe, because we want our offices open so that Alaskans can come and have that one-on-one engagement with that eligibility technician, and we need to make sure that it's safe. So those are the big, again, arcs of effort that we're doing to immediately focus. There's been a lot of effort put into this. This is in partnership and listening to our partners, listening to our staff and the resources that they need and what we can execute now. So the contracts for the virtual call center is signed. The staff are being hired for our IT. The communication is signed. The two security contracts are still with procurement, still going through that process. And then staffing, I'm very happy to say that we have good applicants and we're working through that process. So the next slide, slide 22, part of what I mentioned was, you know, the outreach to the advocacy groups and the direct providers. You know, they're hearing and we're, you know, from Alaskans that are impacted. And we are always open to ideas and solutions. And so we wanted to share with you the eight solutions that they provided to us, and again, what our response is. So the first is lengthening the certification period. And we fully agree. Right now, for SNAP specifically, it's a 6-month certification period. So every 6 months, you need to be recertified, and that you go through a redetermination, re-verification if you qualify for SNAP. We're going through the process to reprogram EIS to lengthen that to 12 months. So that is one area that will help us, because we're still supporting Alaskans, but instead of connecting with them with SNAP every 6 months, it'll be 12 months. The EIS system reprogramming began this month, and once it's completed, it will be fully implemented. Targeted, we're looking right around March. They're going to be testing the reprogramming to ensure that it works. And if it works, then we're looking at that May-June timeframe for training our staff and fully implementing. So that's the timeframe around lengthening certification periods. The next is waiving unnecessary interviews. We agree. Alaska received a waiver from the Food Nutrition Services. That's a federal agency, FNS. And it granted the flexibility for applications and recertifications for the period of October 1st, 2022 to September 30th, 2023. The third suggestion was to streamline the review of housing, utilities, and dependent care costs. We agree. And so just to streamline the workflow and increase eligibility's processing timelines, DPA is amending the shelter and utility expense verification process to temporarily suspend the requirement for verification and accept the client's statements. The fourth suggestion was to implement the broad-based categorical eligibility. And so the department will review this option again. We put this consideration on hold when the prior federal administration proposed a rule that would have ended the broad-based eligibility nationwide. So we're going to review that again. The fifth suggestion was to extend 1 month of SNAP benefits for all who are delayed because of agency's faults. And really, it's due to our system limitations that case must be worked manually and touched by an eligibility technician. So there's no way to add an extra month of benefits because once you get in there, you work that case. So we don't have a mechanism to add an extra benefit automatically. The sixth was to establish a cost-effectiveness threshold and compromise overpayment claims, and the department will review our practices and options under the federal program rules. The seventh is recruit and train more fee agents. Fee agents are contractors. It's a term that's used by the Food Nutrition Services, but they're contractors. And we agree, the division recognizes that fee agents are a valuable tool in supporting the efficient administration of SNAP benefits. One barrier to expanding the use of fee agents is a federal regulation that limits the use of the fee agents to those communities not within 50 miles of a DPA office. So this is really impacting our urban communities. DPA plans to expand fee agents in twofold. First, to seek a waiver of federal regulation due to this extraordinary temporary situation that has created an increase in applications. And second, increase outreach to find individuals willing to serve as fee agents. And the Division of Public Assistance does have staff, and they're dedicated to this effort to outreach and education and training. And then finally, the improved website capacity. The division has developed an online SNAP application that includes the ability for clients to submit supporting documentation. Currently, the online application is in the queue to be reviewed by the IT Security Office to ensure the system meets the required security elements to prevent hackers from attacking the system and safeguarding the personal health information. So we appreciate the solutions or the suggestions. We're very solution focused and just wanted to provide feedback on those eight areas. With that, I will invite Emily Ritchie to discuss slide 23.
Good afternoon. For the record, this is Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health. So I want to spend a little bit of time making sure the committee is aware of something that I think everyone is, there's a lot of talk of and everybody is becoming more and more aware of, which is something called the unwinding of the continuous enrollment for the Medicaid program. Mm-hmm. And these are some important changes that are relative to federal requirements that were implemented during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So in early spring of 2020, as part of the federal response to the public health emergency, states were strongly encouraged to maintain eligibility status for Medicaid enrollees through what has been called the continuous coverage requirements. And basically what this means is that if somebody was determined to be eligible for Medicaid, the normal process for doing redeterminations, reviewing their eligibility criteria, determining every 6 or every 12 months if they in fact remain eligible for Medicaid, those were all suspended during this time period. And really, there were only three ways a state could disenroll Medicaid beneficiaries. One is if they contacted the state and asked to be disenrolled. Two, if they moved out of state. Or three, if they were deceased. So to help cover the costs of maintaining this increased enrollment through this time period, states received enhanced federal funding of 6.2%. We refer to that as a 6.2% FMAP. So for the past 6 months or so, probably honestly a little bit more than that, as there's been kind of considerable discussion at the national level of the ending of the public health emergency, the continuous enrollment requirement was associated with that. And there was a lot of speculation and concern from states as to how, when the end would be announced, how much time states would have to begin the process of unwinding this continuous enrollment requirements. And so at the end of December in 2022, federal legislation, the omnibus bill, passed, and that clearly outlined the timeline and expectations for ending continuous enrollment of Medicaid. And that effectively kind of separated the ongoing discussion and speculation about when these requirements would end from the public health emergency. Now, I would note that just this week, the federal government announced that the federal public health emergency will end May 11th. So that announcement came. However, states were notified back in December when this legislation passed that this particular aspect of that, the continuous enrollment would end effective March 31st. So what this means is essentially effective April 1st, Alaska will need to begin redeterminations for Medicaid eligibility, as will every other state in the U.S. Alaska will have 12 months to complete all eligibility determinations. So to put that in perspective, there's about 260,000 Alaskans that are currently enrolled in the Medicaid program. And beginning April 1, for a 12-month period, the state will need to undertake the redetermination process for reviewing their status in the Medicaid program. Now, Alaska has 12 months to undertake this process, so it's not that April 1 all applications will be reviewed at once. Again, we are planning to step this out over 12 months, and the state will have 14 months from April 1st to actually finish the discontinuation of benefits for those who are not eligible at that disenrollment. We view this effort really, when we think about what needs to happen, as twofold. One, we need to ensure that we have the systems and the processes in place to manage this redetermination effort. The second is to think about the public communication of this requirement and what Alaskans can expect. So Alaska, like every other state in the U.S., is looking at this deadline coming, thinking about the work that's required, and planning ahead. The Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, CMS, which is a branch of the federal government, understands the effort that's involved and has actually been very, very proactive in outlining what states need to do to be prepared. They are requesting states submit certain technical plans that meet the requirements that they've outlined to undertake this unwinding process. Our plan is due to CMS by February 15th, and we've been having meetings with them already. They've been actually very supportive in providing technical assistance. The division began reprogramming in advance, knowing that this was coming at some point, but not necessarily knowing the exact date, this past fall. So going back to what Commissioner Designee Hedberg was saying, there are two systems really that manage eligibility, Medicaid eligibility in the Division of Public Assistance. One is called ARES, the other is called EIS. We spent a lot of time talking about EIS because that is the system that supports the SNAP program and is so problematic for the division right now. But the majority of Medicaid applications are actually stored in the ARES system. And ARES is a newer system, and there's lots of programming support available. So that system is scheduled to have updated programming to support the redetermination effort effective February 28th. So we're going to have a month to test the programming that's gone in place to support the effort in the ARES system prior to it actually taking effect. We are also working very diligently on building out a public communications plan. We've had some meeting with stakeholders, particularly over the last 2 weeks, to talk about what that communication plan is and really to leverage and to ask for their help in making sure that Alaskans understand kind of what they can expect over the next 12 months and really to make sure that they're paying attention. We don't want people throwing out pieces of paper that are really important. So we're working with stakeholder groups, and we're also working closely with the Division of Insurance, who manages a federally facilitated marketplace, because one of the things that we anticipate is that as enrollees, maybe their income has increased, and so they're disenrolled from the Medicaid program, but they would be eligible for coverage under the federally facilitated marketplace. So our goal is to really make sure that as we work through this process, we focus on helping people stay covered. Again, February 15th is the date that we will have our technical plans essentially finalized and sent to CMS for review. And after that date is also when we anticipate holding fairly numerous meetings with our stakeholder groups to really outline our public communications plan on this effort. I would also add, looking in the box on the right-hand side, so I mentioned earlier that states received enhanced federal funding of 6.2% during this period of continuous enrollment. That continuous enrollment, again, ends March 31st, so effective April 1st. There is a step down in that enhanced FMAP, which will eventually end at the end of 2023. So in order for the state to maintain the enhanced FMAP During the step-down periods, there are certain requirements that we must follow, including reporting requirements. And so that's partly why we're so focused on making sure these technical plans with CMS are ready to go by February 15th to make sure that we maintain that enhanced FMAP. So this will be a long effort. This will last, again, for the next, 12 to 15 months. I anticipate a lot more communication about this. And I think my final note that is important for people who are tracking this is that while the redeterminations will begin April 1st, disenrollment from the Medicaid program as a result of the redetermination process will begin to occur May 31st, so 60 days after the redetermination process occurs.
Great, thank you. And our final slide before we get to questions. I'd like to invite up Josie Stern, Assistant Commissioner. She'll review the budget.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Josie Stern. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health. Just briefly about me, I moved to Alaska in 2013. I started working for the state in 2014 as an auditor with the Division of Legislative Audit. I then went to the Department of Law and most recently was a budget analyst at the Office of Management and Budget. So what you have before you today is the Department of Health's operating budget. Again, the Department of Health includes the divisions of behavioral health, healthcare services, public health, public assistance, senior and disability services, departmental support services, and Medicaid services. And the slide reflects a comparison of the FY 2022 actuals to the current fiscal year 2023 management plan, and then the proposed FY 2024 governor's budget that was released on December 15th. This slide does not include departmental support services, human services, community matching grants, and community initiative matching grants, which are generally presented as a consolidated item. And the reason why these were not included was that many changes associated with the bifurcation of the former Department of Health and Social Services occurred in departmental support services. And so this was pulled out of this slide as it doesn't really provide an accurate apples-to-apples comparison across fiscal years. If we include departmental support services, the total operating budget in FY 2024 governor is about $3.14 billion. There are 1,453 full-time positions with the Department of Health, and the majority of the FY 2024 budget, as well as the Department of Health, resides in Medicaid services. The total funds that sit in Medicaid services is about $2.5 billion.
Great, thank you so much. That concludes our department overview.
Thank you. And it occurred to me that 4 and maybe 6 people are kind of going through this for the first time. And you've answered a lot of my questions, but I got to thinking back about 2 years ago, and none of this made much sense. So we might have to figure out something. There might be some additional things to invite you back and do another review in smaller bites. But with that, questions, Representative Fields, Representative Mina, and then Representative Summers.
Thanks to the chair. Great update. Love this department. Thanks for the work that everyone in the department does. And I just wanted a little clarity on Medicaid enrollment. So I understand that the eligibility review will happen starting in April. No one will be kicked off before May. But starting in May, will anyone be kicked off whose eligibility has not been reviewed? In other words, we're not going to unintentionally churn anyone, are we?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, for the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. The goal is absolutely to avoid unintentionally disenrolling anyone from the Medicaid program who is eligible. And there is a lot of effort going into making sure that that does not happen. Largely, again, through making sure that we are able to contact those individuals whose eligibility is being redetermined, that they understand why they're being contacted, that they are responsive and can provide the information that they need in a timely way. So there are a lot of requirements that we are working through, and this is part of the technical plans that CMS requires to make sure that we are connecting to some of the national databases for address change, requiring us to use more than one method of communication for individuals, and then outlining certain circumstances where you can take action and cannot take action.
Mr. Chairman, can I just ask a couple more questions on this subject?
Sure.
Thank you. That in terms of those databases, I was reading that some states are doing administrative or ex parte reviews. Do we have the capacity to do that to save some time and go through these more efficiently, or do we not have the capacity to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Fields, Emily Ricci. When we do have the ability to conduct some ex parte reviews, I think every state is trying to conduct as many of those, what we're almost calling automatic renewals, as possible. So those are renewals that happen in the system without a member having to provide information or intervene, which means that their file in the system can connect to other data sources that we have to provide the information necessary to determine that they remain eligible for coverage. When I was describing the two systems, the ARIES versus the EIS, probably one of the most important parts of the programming that's underway and scheduled to be done by February 28th is the ability for those individuals whose enrollment is maintained in the ARIES program to have those ex parte or those auto renewals occur. That's what the bulk of that programming is towards. There's a lot of speculation as to what percentage of the population those renewals will apply to. I've been on the phone with probably about 15 different states over the last 3 days trying to get an estimate from them on what they experience, and there's some really wild variations. I think California is estimating 25 to 35%. Louisiana is upwards of 50%. So it really varies.
Thanks. I just have one more question on this administrative review. Yes. I don't know enough about eligibility of SNAP versus Medicaid to know if one is eligible for SNAP, then is one also eligible for Medicaid. But is there any opportunity to use the SNAP process to also expedite processing of Medicaid and avoid churn? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, this is Emily Ricci with the Department of Health. There is, and I think that's part of what we're working through with a plan, is outside of just looking at the redeterminations on a schedule, if someone is applying, if for some reason someone is applying for a program like SNAP and they're also eligible for Medicaid, and that information occurs within this 12-month period, do you need to conduct a further redetermination for Medicaid, or can you utilize information when they apply to manage that? And those are some of the kind of scenarios that we're working through internally. Again, the goal is to be as efficient as possible, both for our technicians and for our beneficiaries.
Thank you.
Do we have more questions on this subject before we move on? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, first, I just wanted to thank the Department of Health for all of the work that you've been doing overall, and especially with the split. I know there have been a lot of different problems and issues, and I really appreciated the open communication and the update. So thank you, everyone, for the work that you've been doing, particularly related to Medicaid redetermination. I am really glad to hear that there is proactive work being done on ARIES with stakeholders and the Division of Insurance, because my big concern is I don't want people to get kicked off and not be covered if they are eligible for being covered. And I want my constituents and Alaskans to know that they're eligible for a special enrollment period. So I'm wondering, what resources are there currently to help people with that individual marketplace enrollment once we have the redetermination process? I know United Way has ACA navigators that help, and how we as legislators can help our constituents through this process and your department.
Through the chair, Representative Mina. So those are some really great questions. For the record, this is Emily Ricci. And ones that, again, we are working to, I think, kind of flesh out for the next few weeks in terms of what resources are available for the federally facilitated marketplace. I would defer those to my colleagues in the Division of Insurance. I never want to speak for them. But we want to leverage every opportunity we have to coordinate not only with them, but with our external stakeholders. I would note that, we're in this time period where we are developing these plans. You know, we will start to be able to very clearly articulate to Alaskans, particularly affected particularly beginning April 1st, you know, what needs to happen and what action steps that they can take. But we're in this period now where I think people want to take action. And so one of the things that we can ask of you and of other stakeholders is what people can do right now is to make sure that their information is updated with our department. We want to make sure that, again, we can reach people. That's probably one of the largest concerns that we have about this is making sure we have updated information. So at the end of next week, there will be an option in the VCC call center where there will be a kind of a separate queue established and a technician assigned to that queue to specifically be available to accept updated contact information for individuals who call in. Again, that's not available today. That will be available by the end of next week. But that is a way that Alaskans can begin to make sure that they're prepared for the process is to call the VCC, select the option in the queue. You'll be able to speak with an eligibility technician who can update their information in the system.
Follow up?
Follow up.
So for through the chair for the two different actions that individuals can do, so they can call the VCC, and is there an online link too? Because I know that some individuals do have long wait times, so if there's an online pathway, that'd be great as well.
Through the chair, Representative Mina, I don't believe that there's the ability right now for people to engage with these portals online. That's part of the issue that we're struggling with, quite frankly, so that VCC is the best option. We are working to establish a webpage on the division's website specifically focused on the Medicaid redetermination eligibility effort. We're going to be developing regular e-newsletters that we can send out to stakeholders. I mean, just more communication on this topic in a centralized location where people can go and get updates on what they need to do and where stakeholder groups can direct people with frequently asked questions and things like that.
Thank you.
Rep. Sumner? Oh, is this same subject? Thank you,
Chair Prox. And first of all, let me thank both of you and the rest of the staff for being here and answering questions today and giving a great presentation. So this is obviously a very serious situation with the unwinding of continuous enrollment, which sounds like something from an RPG game of some sort. But you've mentioned some of the communications plans. I deal with individuals in this realm on a regular basis. Sometimes that communication struggles to reach certain folks that just really aren't in the world of Department of Health, or it's just very difficult for them to know. Similar to the question from Representative Fields, I think there might be an opportunity here for some messaging, similar to how messaging was done during the pandemic about opportunities and things that were available. I feel like the Department of Health did a very good job at messaging that. When we have a full, almost third of our population relying on some of these benefits, I feel like some of this is going to come out of thin air to people that maybe it felt like, wow, the state hasn't bothered me in an awful long time. And now everything's ruined, and that's how it's going to go. What are some plans for that communication? Is it radio, television, Facebook, places that people are at?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, for the record, this is Emily Ricci. That is part of the communication plan that we're developing right now, is really thinking about what kind of advertising can we do, what is appropriate, what kind of support can we leverage from our stakeholders for things like that. Recently, we've kind of sent a bulletin wide out to all of our divisions saying, how do you communicate with any of your stakeholders, people, providers, you know, whoever? Are there ways that we can leverage some of the provider notices that Healthcare Services sends out? To give them more information about this and help them direct. We're really trying to leverage anyone that interacts with someone with a beneficiary of the system, whether that's a provider, a stakeholder group, your offices. How can we make sure that they have the information available and easily in a way that's easily understood to try to help that person at that time? I know one of the things that CMS developed was a toolkit. And where many states have taken that toolkit and kind of adapted it. So again, this is information that other groups can take and utilize to communicate with their membership, and we're doing the same thing. We're working on adapting that toolkit. So to answer your question, I don't think there's a single way that we think is going to be most effective. So it's almost like the scattershot approach. Like, how can we get information out there in as many different methods as possible to make people aware of this? And we're going to need help in doing that effectively.
Rep. Sumner?
Yeah, so I actually had a question on the state of health slide for leading causes of death in Alaska. And go back to that. But so it's a percentage of total deaths, and if you add up all the Alaska columns, it totals to 99.9%, but the columns for the United States add up to 76.6 or something. So what's killing 23% of Americans that doesn't kill any Alaskans? Is it, or is it just that maybe those are just not classified deaths, or so we're doing a better job of classifying? So I'm just trying to understand, like, are we really seeing that much more cancer deaths, or is it just that other states are not classifying them the same way or something?
So, Representative Sumner, through the chair, fantastic question, and I'm happy to provide a lot more information. There is an annual death review report that we put together every year through the HAVR section, and they actually just put it out. It's quite large, about the size of this binder, so I didn't bring the whole thing with me, but it classifies multiple types of deaths. I would say that in general, the United States as a whole tries to classify deaths in a very similar fashion. And so there are standard ways of, you know, what do you cause of death? What's the primary cause of death? What's the underlying cause of death? I would state that health is complex, you know, so you might have someone who has heart disease and has cancer and then gets COVID-19, you know, and so you can have multiple things. But for these reports, they look at what's called the primary cause of death. So that's the first thing that a physician will list on the death certificate, is kind of the primary cause of death. And that's really a clinical judgment. When you ask about the differences between the United States as a whole versus here, if you look at these, those kind of top causes of death, we're kind of dominating all of those areas. And so then the multitude of other causes of death are making up more of the percentage of the lower 48 as a whole. But I'd be happy to provide more details for you about the U.S. As a whole and where those death numbers come from. I wouldn't say that our classifications are really different. We really try across the country to use a very standardized way of doing it. And we actually share this process with the CDC. They also look at it and sometimes come back to us and say, this isn't making sense, or help us understand this. So there's kind of this two-way conversation that we have with federal agencies and with other states on a regular basis to try to make it as comparable as possible. I hope that answers your question.
Same subject, perhaps?
Unrelated, so okay. Wait in the back of the line.
If you could, yes, please. Would be a whole discussion in itself, statistics, because this specific thing came up last June or something, people called me. But on slide 3, I was curious on the life expectancy versus health cost. And Alaska is right next to New York as far as being expensive. And I can't think of two states more different than Alaska and New York. And I was looking for Florida as a comparison, couldn't even find it. So it's somewhere in the middle. Are there any identifiable reasons for these disparate costs per person in healthcare?
Chair Prox, fantastic question. There's many different ways in which we can spend money on very different things for different reasons. If you look back at older data like 2018, 2019, you primarily saw rural communities driving a lot of the more expensive cost per capita, just really expensive to get care in rural communities. So if you look like in North Dakota, South Dakota, it's continued to be quite expensive on here. Texas has been quite expensive for some time, West Virginia, Alaska in general. Hawaii was more expensive and has kind of come down. And DC Ritchie can comment on this, as well as Division of Insurance. There's a lot of different ways in which we pay for healthcare, and you'll see a lot of states trying to move more towards prevention, more towards managed care, more ways to be able to incentivize preventative measures to help to minimize the downstream impacts of, you know, someone showing up much later to the emergency department with, you know, stage 3 colon cancer, stage 4 colon cancer, and then their cost is much more expensive and decreases their life expectancy. Some of the challenges in Alaska have made that particularly challenging, just with our size and our state. We have amazing tribal partners that we work with, but they're really different systems in which we provide care, as well as kind of different federal payment systems that have made it challenging in Alaska to find unique ways of providing care at a cheaper cost. I don't totally know why New York's has gone up. That was surprising to me when we were running this data specifically on there, and have been asking a bunch of other healthcare experts in this field to kind of understand that one as an outlier, because I'd agree they're very different states in that component. But we do continue to see that when you have delayed care, you tend to get higher care just because people end up presenting later in services. So I don't know if that's a component in New York or not, but we can look into it more.
Oh, no, it just probably doesn't matter. It's just a comparison. It's just what we need to be concerned about is what is driving the cost in Alaska and do something about that. So, thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. Just wanted to go back to an earlier slide on the Senior and Disability Services Infant Learning Program. I'm just not that familiar with that program, and I was curious about its scope. How many people does it reach? How many people should it reach? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, for the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. So the Infant Learning Program is a resource for infants and toddlers to be connected with services to support healthy development when they have a developmental disability or are at risk for one. Any child under 3 years old who shows at least a 50% delay in certain developmental areas is eligible for this early intervention program. There is no charge for core services, and most programs will bill Medicaid or private insurance for other services. Referrals can be made by anyone familiar with the child and with a caregiver's consent. And I do not have numbers in terms of how many individuals participate in the program, but we will follow up with that.
Okay, thank you. And if I could just ask a follow-up. So this one program made me think of a little broader question. If our goal is to reduce childhood trauma and adverse childhood experiences, you know, I couldn't tell you what are the 10 light items we should be most focused on in your budget. And I would appreciate the department getting back to us as we go into this budget subcommittee process. If that was our goal, what should we be funding and where are the gaps? Thank you.
Representative Meenan.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, I have a question related to the Division of Public Health slide on slide 13, specifically on expanded work on addressing the opioid epidemic. I'd love to hear more about the work that's being done outside of the distribution of naloxone kits, which is great.
Great. For the record, this is Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer for the State of Alaska, through the Chair, Representative Mina. Our Office of Substance Misuse, Opioid Addiction and Prevention, our OSMAP office, now sits within our section of chronic disease prevention and health promotion. The work that they do is quite extensive. They work very closely with the Division of Behavioral Health because they also do a lot of work in this field specifically. So a couple things that I would highlight besides the distribution of naloxone, which has been extensive and, in fact, has been our largest year of distribution ever with over 18,000 kits required just in the last 6 months, is a lot of community cafes. So working with communities to identify what are their goals, what are they seeing in specific response to the opioid epidemic. We work closely with the division, the Department of Public Safety, on what they're doing for opioid mitigation, work together in communities to understand what's coming in, what's coming out, how can we communicate to the community about, you know, one pill can kill. We see right now approximately 6 out of 10 counterfeit pills that come into a community that may look like a Percocet or an Ambien or Norco is actually counterfeit and likely contains fentanyl. And unfortunately, because they are counterfeit, there's no measurement to make sure that it is safe. And so just one pill can have enough fentanyl in it to have someone die from that one ingestion. So fentanyl is incredibly deadly, incredibly small amounts that can be mixed into other medications very easily. So just awareness. We're particularly concerned about this, and many of our advocates talk about this as a poisoning that's coming into communities because it may not be someone who is addicted to opioids. It may not be someone who's using opioids regularly, but they might be at a party and their friend has one and they just take one and that may be enough to kill. And so that's why we really just want to make sure that our youth are understanding this. They know that this is entering every state in the country and it's including Alaska, and it's reaching even our most rural areas within the state. So lots of information about that, making sure, as you mentioned previously, people have access to naloxone, because then if someone sees someone who's unresponsive, naloxone can reverse that opioid overdose and give that person a chance for recovery. Or again, if this was just an accidental, took a pill, gives them a chance to live and be able to go on from there. We're working a lot with industry to get out naloxone kits in industry, particularly our seafood industry, with Project Gabe, and that has been initiated. We're also working with the Division of Behavioral Health on medication-assisted therapy. So when we look at what the best evidence-based approach, this has also been changing rapidly as SAMHSA, the federal agency that helps to kind of fund and oversee behavioral health and mental health, has changed some of the prescription requirements regarding prescribing medication-assisted therapy. So working a lot with our providers to understand what that looks like and how they can support, and then recovery service areas. So how can people be connected to recovery service, mental health services, or other services within their community? And as Representative Fields had mentioned previously, everything from a trauma for youth and what that looks like, working with our Office of Children's Services, helping to understand at-risk families, all the way through a potential risk of addiction. So broad and diverse, and happy to provide more information.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, just on that same topic for opiate epidemic, one of the things that we had talked about maybe in times past was the data regarding overdoses in this state and how that, and we've talked a lot about computer systems and all of that, but how data currently within the department is siloed and maybe not usable to a great degree, especially to providers of care. Is there any sort of effort ongoing to help solve some of that, maybe adding some overdose data or risk of overdose into prescription drug monitoring programs and things of that nature?
Yeah, Representative Ruffridge, through the chair, it's a fantastic question. The prescription drug monitoring program, the PDMP, is not administered by our department, but we work closely with that department. There is some additional information that is in there. We're currently working through the process right now, an evaluation of the PDMP on what are the strengths, weaknesses, and benefits on the current system and what ways we can use that better in the future. So we are just looking at that initial draft report and hope to have that out here shortly and be able to provide more information about how we can use the PDMP specifically. We do have an opioid dashboard that I would point people towards, and that includes everything from overdoses in a region. You can also look per capita. I think it is really important, as Representative Prax had mentioned, on looking at statistics. You know, Anchorage will always look the worst if you look at just per numbers. And so we do have on there per capita to make sure that we're really looking at the relative risk per based on the population. And on there, you can see overdoses, you can see naloxone distribution, you can also see emergency department visits via syndromic surveillance of people showing up to the emergency department with a potential overdose and what that looks like. I think there's a lot of work to do in this area. So you've seen a lot of the IT challenges and struggles that we've had within DPA. But as mentioned, that affects everything from what we can get up on our website to our ability to share other data and data sources, and making sure that we have data that's secure and data that makes sure it protects patient information, but it also gets it into patients' hands and into communities where they can understand de-identified data so that they can take action. And that is our fundamental goal. We did, in conjunction with the HIE, the Health Information Exchange, host an all-day meeting actually just this past Friday based on complex care, opioids, care across communities, and what we're all doing in this space and how we can work better from an IT, from a private and public sector perspective. So what the department can do better, what other departments can do better, and what we can do with our partners. And we're excited to have the HIE help to stand into this space more so that that kind of pooled data pools can help both us see where we're functioning, where we're not functioning, and us get that information out to communities better. I really think that data is how we're going to transform our health systems, and our lack of IT infrastructures has been a huge challenge within the state overall, and something that we're all very focused on improving. So thanks for asking that.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, on slide six, I'm really interested on about the Office of Health Savings, and I'm really glad that there is a specific focus on healthcare savings. I have a couple of questions related to the office. Number one, how many positions are there in the office? Number two, will this office be looking at healthcare costs related to social determinants of health? And I love the emphasis on that in your framing. Number three, will it be looking at costs that are outside of state expenditures, so healthcare costs within private facilities, et cetera? And number fourth, I know there's currently the RFP for the health payer utilization database. Will that be housed in here, or will that be connected through DOI?
Representative Mina, through the chair, this may be a group effort response on this, so I will start, but I will turn over to many of our colleagues in the space. I think we all are very focused on what we can do for health savings, how we can use our current and existing divisions, but we have clearly identified that we need more help in this region. And to do that, we need personnel to be able to do this. So as you see from this slide, we really focused on things like the Medicaid program and pharmacy benefits, places that we saw really early wins to be able to create health savings. But that does not mean it stops there, and how we can work with other divisions. One thing that we've really been thinking broadly about when you ask about, you know, how many positions this looks like or what this looks like, you know, our current ask, and I will have to refer to Josie and to Heidi to speak about that specific budgetary ask, is quite small, but it is to coordinate across all of our divisions so that we're looking broadly, like in our rural section, our REACHA section, they do a lot of work looking at healthcare systems management. Our chronic does that as well. So how can we pool and utilize other federal grants that are coming in, other works that are happening in the division, and bringing that together so we can look at social determinants of health? For example, emergency medicine billing practices from CMS changes of January 1st. That includes much more emphasis on coding for social determinants of health. So how can you use that in a billing practice that's been changed federally to be able to better understand where patients are getting access to healthcare and the rest of it to be able to move forward? So I would say that there's a lot to be determined yet in this position and how we're thinking about it. Part of it is if we can kind of get the funding to move forward with a focus on beginning steps. But anyone else? Oh, yeah. Database. The utilization database is not in our department, but there's some funding to connect Medicaid specifically to it. So it is in the Division of Insurance. Thank you. I have helpers here from behind. They're the ones, but we helped do the RFP together and are out there. And we're currently working with our security team to look at our data to make sure it can be securely transferred to that database to be able to utilize it. So it's not going to be managed by us, but Medicaid information will be shared with it.
Thank you. Follow up real quickly.
Quickly.
Where can we find the RFP for the HPUD?
I'm sure we can send it to you. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Through the chair, Representative Mina, the Division of Insurance will have it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, so I have essentially a question on every slide. So whenever you ask a question on a slide, I will follow up with a question. Yes, please.
No, I forgot which number, but it was close to this. I believe it was slide five. Nope. Anyway, the something new that was mentioned was postpartum care, which A, is going to cost probably considerably more money, and B, probably provide considerably more benefit, hopefully. Are we looking and calculating, it's kind of cold for healthcare, but the cost-benefit analysis to the state as a whole on these programs?
Representative Prax, the chair, it is a challenging calculation to do. You know, if you're helping to prevent you know, a preterm birth that could result in lifelong disability, particularly when you get numbers as small as Alaska and Alaska's population, that can be challenging as a whole. Mm-hmm. What we saw with postpartum coverage is it's required for Medicaid to cover for the first 60 days, but we started to see states move to 360 days or to one full year. We've seen many states move that direction. Early data out of Texas and some data out of California showed decrease in maternal deaths as well as increased life expectancy for the mother out of that first year. So again, decreased deaths, better connection for those mothers and better connection for those children to preventative services early on. When you ask about cost-benefit analysis, that can be really hard, again, from a small state perspective, and our calculations are based on just what it would cost to cover those people, but it's hard to calculate out the longer-term costs, but we have estimates from the national data from particularly Texas and California suggesting a significant savings as you are creating early better beginnings for that family as a whole. So yes and no, I hope that answers your question.
Yes. Well, it's an interesting challenge, I guess, for this committee, representatives of the whole state, this committee in education committee, same thing. Investment up front probably can save a lot of money down the road in both areas. And eventually, I hope to be able to run the Department of Corrections out of business, for instance. But figuring out how to do that is a challenge. Representative Sadler.
Real briefly, through the chair, I guess this goes to Commissioner Desking-Hedberg. Slide 17, there's reference to the difficulty in finding staff to basically to program and work on COBOL systems. How long is it going to take to extinguish COBOL and hopefully move to a system? You may have made reference to this if I missed it in the plethora of information. I'm sorry, but how long is it going to take to update to more modern platforms that won't take as much legacy talent?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sadler, I would love to answer that question with a very specific timeline. The reprogramming, there's different arcs of effort. So the first arc of effort is the certification. So moving SNAP from, so SNAP certification from 6 months to 12 months, that reprogramming needs to happen first. There's additional reprogramming that needs to happen, and I can follow up with and let you know the details of those additional reprogramming that has to happen to even frame EIS that has two programs. It has SNAP and it has some portions of Medicaid. We need to reprogram to get it to a place to then take those two programs off of EIS and move it over to ARES. So I'll have to follow up with you on that timeline. I just know right now we're focused on the certification, and that's where it started in January. In March, they're going to be testing that reprogramming, and then May, June is when they're going to be rolling that out if the testing is successful.
So what I hear you saying is that you got to stick with it for a while to get in shape to migrate to a new platform?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you. So I'll start with that slide, and then I'll move back to the slide 5 and 6. But so is there a significant error rate in this system, sort of a mismatch of a bunch of different programs and things? Do you ever just have user error with all of this, or because there's a lot of systems, is it user error free, or is there an error rate associated with this?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, yes, there are errors. And I know that because when I ask for statistics and they pull down the Excel documents, they have to be manually verified and manually corrected. I don't know what the percentage is on the error rate, but there are errors.
Okay, I follow up if I may. Mm-hmm. The word manual scares the snot out of me, I'm just going to be honest. So back to slide 5 and 6. There were some things in there that really caught my attention. Somebody said the phrase payment for prevention. That caught my attention, and I was hoping we could have a little bit more detail there. And then I always obviously perk up at reducing pharmacy costs. I'm wondering what is that a formula driven, or what is the, I guess, mechanism behind reduction of that cost?
Representative Ruffridge, to the chair, I will start with the prevention and then I will hand the pharmacy benefits either over to Heather or to Emily a little bit more to talk about the work that we've already done within Medicaid on that topic. As Representative Prax had mentioned previously, it's very hard to calculate prevention, and that is the prevention paradox that we are oftentimes struggled in with healthcare overall. As mentioned, we have really looked at the areas where we could find the best data-driven evidence for being able to improve health and decrease costs, and that's why you see these three kind of buckets between the healthy beginnings, the healthcare access, and healthy communities. Each of these, as Commissioner Designee Hedberg talked about, have behind them this kind of four-year plan of existing programs as well as new programs to be able to think about where are we ready as a system to be able to change or to be able to move, where do we have capacity, how can we move, what programs are ready within Alaska, and how do we have this four-year plan of really trying to make this the best pace in the state, the best state in the country to raise a family and to really have these healthy beginnings to move on prevention. So there's many things along the prevention continuum along those lines, and happy to kind of go in more depth. We do have a website up on this topic as of now, so we're trying to provide more and more information along those lines so that people can oversee that space. And if there's a certain area of prevention that you have more questions on, happy to dive into that because it's quite broad.
Yeah, there, I think my question was more along the lines of, you know, sometimes people need an incentive to work down the prevention angle. So I didn't know if particular individuals were going to get paid to be more preventative or if that was providers that were going to get paid. I heard payment for prevention and I just didn't know what that was referencing. So thank you.
Yeah, Representative Ruffridge, through the chair, there are already many things that we do in existence, both for providers and for patients. So for example, a TB patient, we have kind of incentives and mechanisms to continue to take their TB medication so that we don't develop a multi-drug resistant tuberculosis that is much more prevalent in the community. So that would be an example of a incentive that we use that isn't prevention for that one person, it's treatment for that person, but preventing multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, for example. Things like the Fresh Start campaign are cost on our system, and then we use federal funds for those, but those are all free programs to do things like decrease weight, improve hypertension, and those are all kind of prevention efforts where then, well, we're not paying someone to participate, we're offering a free service to help to support them, free counseling, free apps, things like that to be able to connect them. So there's incentives along those lines. And then paying providers, absolutely. There's a lot that we're thinking about in terms of how do we decrease the bureaucracy needed for providers? How do we simplify the work that they do? And how can we help to incentivize their work with prevention? So it may be simple things like the Docket app that now you can download your own vaccines into. And so if you're at your doctor's office and they're like, when have you been vaccinated? Patients can pull that down themselves and to provide additional information to it. Or using the HIE that they can upload their patient panel and say, I want to know my patient panel who may have gone into other emergency departments, or I want to know my patient panel that has not been vaccinated and I want to be able to support them or set up a longer appointment because I know that they've been to the emergency department for 5 days. How can we provide additional services and tools like that? So depending on what part in the healthcare system, there are existing mechanisms and need to be more to really incentivize prevention. And to your second question with pharmacy, DC Retreat.
For the record, Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Health, through the Chair, Representative Ruffridge. There's been, I think, an increasing awareness of the opportunity to leverage additional savings through the pharmacy programs across multiple state divisions. And I know this is an area that we've worked on in the past. That was my knee. So in relation, I want to start by just talking a little bit about the work that our healthcare services division is doing. I think they've started leveraging opportunities to receive rebates for certain types of medications that are used by beneficiaries, as well as being more aggressive with updating essentially lists that outline which medications are perhaps more financially favorable with equal therapeutic effects at any given time. So that's one work that's been ongoing with healthcare services. I think they leveraged about $45 million in savings in FY22. I think that number is low. They actually anticipate leveraging more. And I think with some additional support, there's more opportunity for this program to grow specifically to that healthcare services program. In relation to the Office of Health Savings, you know, there's some really innovative work occurring in other states that we want to take a look at. And again, we need some time and space for someone to be able to do that. We want to look at different ways that we can maybe leverage bulk purchasing different types of medications like insulin. I mean, we've been really successful with doing that with some of the vaccine programs that Alaska has. Are there other types of medications that we could be looking at? I know Utah has a really innovative copay program that's managed through their state health plan, but maybe there's an alternative in Alaska that could work that is, again, kind of leveraging the volume that Alaska has in its different types of state programs to purchase or negotiate lower rates for prescriptions and then make that available to the general public. So those are some of the ideas that we were thinking of specifically related to the Office of Health Savings.
Thank you so much.
Hey, quickly, we are starting to run up against the deadline.
Right, I'll leave my more DPA questions for the Finance Subcommittee, but I will ask one. And I just, through the chair, I just wanted to extend my appreciation for the work being done on the DPA backlog and also knowing that the work that had been done years ago to start to move to an electronic process and Representative Snyder's bill to help that as well. I just wanted to ask quickly about what are the current qualifications for an eligibility tech, what that training process is like, and are we maintaining those same standards with the contracts for additional eligibility techs?
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee, through the Chair, Representative Mina. So the virtual call center, that is, the skill set is very minimal because it is answering the phone, collecting basic information that we ask them to collect, collecting the documents, and that's all that they can provide, which is clerical at best. And they are then sharing that information to our eligibility technicians. And our eligibility technicians, they're passionate. They want to get benefits out, and I think that they're frustrated that they can't work fast enough. And so this is one of the solutions that they've identified that we are supporting. In terms of the minimum qualifications, there's different job classes, and I will need to follow up with you on those minimum qualifications for the different levels of the eligibility technicians.
Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
I told you I have a question on every side.
Yeah.
Just on the eligibility technicians, approximately, maybe we don't have that exact number, but approximately how many eligibility technicians exist in this department currently?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, total PCNs for the Division of Public Assistance is 458. I would have to follow up and let you know how many of them are eligibility technicians. I don't know off the top of my head.
That's, oh, okay. So 458.
They're not all eligibility technicians.
Yep.
Okay. I have 459. I thank you very much. Lots and lots of information. I had kind of forgotten how complicated this is. So over the next 3 weeks, give or take, we're going to be staying at a sort of high level, getting through the budget part of this, and then hopefully we'll get in some of the bills and whatnot. But there is going to be a really steep learning curve. This is my third year thinking about it, and it's still a steep learning curve. So I think that will be a challenge for us to overcome. How are we going to best keep in touch with the department to do the best we can to get up to speed for individuals?
To the chair, if any of you have constituents that reach out and they need assistance with anything within the department, please reach out to Courtney Enright. She's here. She is our legislative liaison. She knows how to take that client ask and connect it into the right program within the department. It's a very large department. Two, we want to make ourselves available to meet with you and answer any of your questions on the variety of programs. This was very much at a 30,000-foot view, but when you start looking deep, there's just amazing work that happens within the Department of Health.
And you do have to get into the weeds to understand it. So final question. Courtney, kind of a nice person. We don't have to be afraid of her.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. With that, thank you for joining us. And this concludes our business for today. And the meeting adjourns at 5:01.